Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And today we're going to talk about ICE some more and some of the rather nefarious shit that they're up to. And it is an absolutely disgusting story. We're also going to talk about political scandal in the age of Trump. So before we get started, though, how was your weekend?
It was really good. I got a lot of work done. I went to SF MoMA, which was great for the first time. I love art. And so just walking around the museum was a lot of fun. It was really good to like sort of decompress at MoMA. So
yeah,
it was a good weekend.
That's really nice. Yeah. I threw a big holiday party on Saturday, which was really fun.
Hey.
And I cooked for it and I never cook. So that was really cool. But I don't cook if I can avoid it. But yeah, so we have a packed show today, as always. We've got a lot of really great feedback on our second Drunkisode, which was so fun to do. And Varsha, you're fucking hilarious.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I am awaiting my Netflix special as we speak. I have reached out. They're gonna
you're
come
in
back.
Talks. Right. Their people are gonna talk to your people,
exactly.
As we say in LA.
Exactly. Okay, Devin, what's been going on with ICE and immigration?
There was this story in the Washington Post I feel like is really indicative of what has been going on with ICE, not just with what's going on at the border with separating children from their parents, but sort of a larger immigration policy and the sort of rampant corruption of ICE in general. I also want to take this opportunity to remind everyone, not that our listeners wouldn't know this, but ICE was established in 2003.
Yeah.
And it's been under the jurisdiction of Department of Homeland Security. But before even ICE was around, I mean, immigration was handled before it was Department of Homeland Security. It was handled through Department of Justice. And before that, it was actually handled by the Department of Labor. So in the last, you know, several decades, we've gone from looking at immigration as something about labor, mm-hmm, to something about justice, to something about security.
Yeah.
So I think that just kind of sets the stage in terms of the evolution of how we view immigration in this country in general, if that makes sense.
It's actually a really dangerous, like from a historian's perspective, it's actually a really dangerous historical trend to see how initially it was a labor issue, because you had a lot of Mexican migrants coming to the U.S. to work in farm labor, to work other types of labor, and then going back to Mexico, right? That was basically how a lot of labor worked, is that people would come here to work for a little bit and then they would go back. You know, there would be very few people who are settling here unless they're coming from Europe, etc., right? And mainly it was a labor issue. And even seeing it as a labor issue caused a lot of problems, as you can tell if you look at the early 20th century and our immigration laws in the early 20th century. But the shift to security is so dangerous, because it not only – because you first have the shift to justice and then to security. So you have the criminalization of immigration, and then you have this idea that not only is it criminal – it's a criminal issue. It's also a security issue, in the sense that immigration is no longer just people deciding to settle here. It's something that shakes to the core of our security. And that's a really frustrating way to look at our national narrative, right? That we see immigration as something that makes us less secure.
Right. And I think this is also indicative. I mean, when you look at any issue, you can look at it through several different lenses. And that's the whole point of intersectionality in general, is that you take those lenses into account when we talk about these complex topics. But yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to the sort of way narratives in this country shift and change. Not, I won't say organically, but the way the sort of historical trends, to borrow a little bit from you, Varsha, in terms of your historian's training, and how today what we're seeing feels almost like a condensed version of that. We're shifting lenses so quickly that the creep from labor to criminalization and the Justice Department to this security issue, like you said, that shakes us to our core, to this sort of fear-mongering, to the point, you know, making the caravan a midterms issue and literally whipping up fear intentionally. I mean, we've really seen a condensed progression of this shift in lens when you talk about immigration.
Exactly.
So, you know, and then, like I said, I mean, ICE has only been around since 2003. There have obviously been other types of immigration enforcement and immigration divisions in the government. But I feel like ICE is this thing that people think or feel is long established, and that they have this sort of power that is rooted in some sort of deep Americana, if that makes sense.
And it's not. It's something that's, it's literally 15 years old. And there are a lot of things that are 15 years old that we don't give a lot of power. Like my brother. My brother should have no power whatsoever. He should have no control over what we eat at night, let alone the country's immigration system. I'm just saying, right? Like, it's very frustrating to see people give a lot of institutional backing to something that we don't know for 100% sure that has been effective, right? Effective in the sense that it makes us a better country. Like, yes, you are spending millions upon millions of dollars deporting people or keeping our border secure or whatever you want to call it, right? But how do we know that that has actually helped our immigration system? Has it made us more quote unquote secure? Or is it like the TSA, where the TSA, a lot of it is security theater in the sense that we aren't able to prevent attacks. We are only able to figure out, oh, after something crappy happens, now we no longer allow water bottles on the plane, right? And I feel like ICE is like that, but with worse, horrific consequences for families across the country and across the globe.
Right. Yeah, the TSA is annoying. And then, as we're about to talk about, ICE is sinister.
Exactly.
Although, you know what? To say that the TSA is just annoying is actually really showing my own privilege. Because to me, TSA is annoying.
Yeah. But
to me, I can't bring
TSA
a water bottle on the plane.
It's sinister because it has been sinister a lot. Yeah.
Exactly. And there's definitely something much more insidious there. And definitely harkens back to this idea of the criminalization and then the fear and the security, quote unquote, risk and the racial profiling that actually encompasses that. So I actually think that my saying that really says a lot about how people interact with these sort of governmental, quote unquote, security agencies in this day and age. So that was very enlightening just having that come out of my mouth. Yeah. But so the story that I want to talk about is actually about a specific person. So it was in the Washington Post, as I mentioned, there was this man named Peter Sean Brown. And he is he was living in Florida and he had violated his parole. He had marijuana in his system, which was a violation of parole. And so he turned himself in to the sheriff's office, thinking, you know, he would deal with the probation, you know, violation and be back to work and, you know, kind of figure this out. So, you know, I also want to point out that when we talk about criminality and illegality, even without taking the piece of the injustice of the justice system, I mean, this was a person who was trying to do the right thing, who violated his parole and was taking steps to correct it.
Exactly.
And I think that, again, is important because this could be easily shifted into a lens of, oh, this guy is a criminal. This guy was violating a law of some kind. And I want to make sure that we take some of that off, even if it's superficial.
Yeah.
So what happened when he got there was ICE issued what's known as an ICE detainer. And basically, you know, they scanned his fingerprints and that those fingerprints were sent to a federal database. And then ICE sent this detainer that basically said that he was to, quote, be deported because of unspecified biometric information. And yeah. And so this, when he got this information, when he was sitting in custody for a parole violation, I mean, he didn't even know what ICE was. I mean, this was like such a shock. Additionally, what's really disgusting about this case is that Brown was born in Philadelphia in 1968. He is a natural born citizen, period. Yeah. So this is again a lot of intersections. There's a lot of different things going on here. There's ICE. There's also this idea of sanctuary cities and cooperation between local and federal agencies, and what can happen when we intertwine those two systems. And again, I think I've talked about this before, and not without complications, but there are pros and cons of interdepartmental information,
especially with ICE. So like basically like what's going on here is that Monroe County, right, where this person, where Brown was arrested and then eventually detained by ICE, it has something called like a basic ordering agreement with ICE. And basically the federal agency is saying, ICE says, we're going to compensate sheriffs around $50 a person to extend the detention of criminal aliens. And so you can agree that if there are, in my imagination, but if there's like a certain city in the country that has a lot of unauthorized immigrants, and a lot of them statistically, according to ICE or whatever data that they have, are committing crimes more than just normal unauthorized immigrants, then fine, you could understand why a police department in that area would want to collaborate with ICE. But that's not actually ever the case. It's very rarely the case, right? It really depends on the local politics of these police stations or these cities or these states where these stations decide whether or not they want to collaborate with ICE. Because in California and a lot of places, you have basically sanctuary cities, but also you have police departments saying, no, we refuse to collaborate with ICE because that makes it harder for us to do our jobs. Right. And you have fewer women and you have fewer people reporting crimes because they are afraid of ICE. Right. And so this is another level of how frustrating this is of what ICE is doing, is that it's making local policing even harder than it is already.
Right. Well, and when I say interdepartmental cooperation, I actually am not even referring to ICE, because I really don't think that something like ICE, which is a very specific and dedicated to a narrow scope, I don't think there's a lot of value in that. The value I'm more talking about is something like a federal database that would help track down, rapists, or that would coordinate, sexual assault victims, or could coordinate, data about murders or other types of crime and statistically, and maybe kind of work together with the federal government and the FBI to create a better system. Because again, the way our country is set up, the decentralization of all this is a feature and a bug, right? It's to keep states' rights, and it's to, to ensure that each state is a little bit different and they're taking care of their citizens in the way that makes most sense to them. But then you also lose a little bit in terms of even application of the law and even, sharing information and committing crimes across state lines, data often gets lost. So, when I say there's value here, I don't actually think that there's much value in terms of ICE. Because again, this is a very new organization and the scope is so narrow that I don't think that federal cooperation is, like you said, it's a hindrance to local police work. And I think furthermore, it's a hindrance to the federal agency, even if in its narrow scope. It's a little bit of speculation on my part, but when we're talking about a fucking system that attaches Word documents to emails and can't keep track of children, obviously they're struggle busing a little bit here. And getting all of these different counties, police offices, sheriff's offices involved, I don't think that's fucking helping.
It's not helping. And I think it's great that the ACLU has brought suit, right, in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. And basically the lawsuit, along with the SPLC, the Southern Poverty Law Center, as well as a L.A.-based law firm, basically the suit is accusing Monroe County's sheriff, Richard Ramsey, of unlawfully arresting and detaining a U.S. citizen in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And it's great that this suit is being brought. And it's great that, you know, the ACLU and other institutions, other organizations are doing this type of work to make sure that ICE is being checked. But it sucks that it has to be done. It sucks right. that ICE doesn't have the capacity to realize, oh, this is so weird. The guy we want to deport to Jamaica has a driver's license in Florida, and you could only get a driver's license if you're definitely a citizen or an authorized migrant or an authorized immigrant, right? That's so weird that he has a driver's license. Like, how did nobody in this whole process think to realize, oh, maybe we should not just rely on fingerprints that have a weird mix up, but we should also maybe rely on other things to figure out if,
like,
this person
documents.
If this person should be deported or not. And I think that's right. so frustrating. And also, this is an issue that I have, like a teeny tiny quibble that I have with the story, right? Where the story talks about how this is another way, quote, the case also reflects yet another front in the ACLU's efforts to frustrate the president's immigration agenda. I think if I looked back before 2016, if I looked from 2008 to 2016 or 2000 to 2016, I'd find other cases of ICE and immigration in general being really shitty to legal
right.
citizens or to legal authorized migrants, because it's happened to me, right? It's happened to me where my family and I had to go to India, and we had to have this thing called an advanced parole. And on the way back, there's like a teeny tiny chance that customs is like, oh no, you have to go back to India. You can't stay in the United States in the process of like getting a green card, right? That's something that happens to people every goddamn day, where the immigration system, the quote unquote legal immigration system, is so messed up that it's very much like a crapshoot. And I hate that this is how we talk about it, as a way that it's frustrating Trump's agenda. Because yeah, it is. On one level, Donald Trump and the administration and Stephen fucking Miller is ruining all of this, is making this even worse than it already is. But on another level, it was already pretty shitty to begin with. It's a pretty shitty process to go through. And it's probably been really shitty to people of color, regardless of their immigration status, regardless of the fact whether they're citizens or not, right?
Well, I mean, I feel like this is kind of the next point that I wanted to make. So I think it's also interesting they wanted to deport him to Jamaica. And this story in particular doesn't exactly illuminate why Jamaica, but like there was no sort of reason for that given, except for the fact that this is a black man.
Yeah.
And I this is obviously about race on top of everything else. And I also take a little bit of issue here with this story and even the approach to this, calling it an immigration case. Mm-hmm. Because yes, ICE is involved, but this isn't an immigrant. This is an American
this
citizen.
This is a civil
this
rights violation case. That's what this is.
Yeah, right. It's immigration because it's dealing with ICE. But and again, to call it frustrating Trump's immigration agenda, I think it's frustrating Trump's racist agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, there are many lenses with which you can view this. And this is obviously a very intersectional issue. And this is not just one thing, obviously. But I feel like the top level of this case is about racism and about the absolute disregard for citizens of color. Because again, you know, not just the fingerprint mix up, but there's also a little complication in the story that said, quote, meanwhile, on an online inmate locator viewed by Brown's friend included eyebrow raising information. By its account, Brown stood 7 feet tall, when in fact he is no more than 5'7". It also listed an incorrect birthday. When his friend called the jail to say they had the wrong man, officers told her the only option was to inform ICE. So again, I'm not going to chalk this up to incompetency, because I think that that's too kind. That's too kind of me. I don't think this is just incompetency. I think this is, again, part of a larger racist agenda that, yes, has to do with immigration, but I think also has to do with this racist understanding of how we view people of color in this country. And again, I'm still like stuck on this. The Washington Post does not tell us why Jamaica. Yeah. And I'm kind of stuck on this. And the only thing I can get to is this idea of like, oh, since he's a black man living in Florida, will deport him to Jamaica. I'm very confused by all of this. But more than just this story and you know, the ACLU bringing this suit, I mean, it really speaks to how the Trump administration is approaching not just immigration and race in this country, but also rule of law. And how there seems to be a deep disregard, even more so than in the past, because as you rightly pointed out, Varsha, this is not fucking new. This is not like something that just popped up as soon as Trump became president, as is true with many of these policies that are, you know, ongoing. But what is true is the way, the blatancy with which they are conducting themselves, and also the way that instead of trying to maybe correct some of this or shift it, they're leaning into it.
I mean, I think you're exactly right. And this is something that we all have learned over the past almost 2 years of this presidency, where like it all comes down to race. And then it's just always about race, because that's just, yeah. I mean, this is also very nerdy of me, but this is basically what I've been telling my students all semester when it comes to the grand narrative of like American history, is that it all comes down to how Americans, quote unquote, white Americans over the past have understood race, and events are vectors of, we can understand events as vectors of how people have understood race. If you look at Native American issues, look at slavery, you look at the Mexican-American War, and also when you go into the 20th century, it's about race, right? And this story is such a great such a great example of that, because the story is about race, but they're talking about it as if it's a, quote, one, immigration story, and two, a story that has to do with politics, that has to do with the politics of immigration, of civil rights, of policing. But really, it's a story about racism.
Right, right. And I also want to say one last thing before we move on, because I also thought a detail in this story that really drove some of this home, exactly what you were saying, Varsha, about race and these events being vectors, is the absolute inhumane way in which he was treated while held in custody. You know, when he tried to plead his case, or when he tried to get answers, when Brown, you know, was just doing anything he could, I mean, he was completely disregarded. He was brushed off. When he asked for help, they said, oh, well, we can't help you with the legal stuff. Do you want to see the law? You want to go to the law library? You know, when he said that he was born in Philadelphia, they started singing the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air theme song. Yeah. And when he expressed concern about being deported to Jamaica because he had only been there once for one day on a cruise, they put on, you know, someone who was holding him in custody put on like a Jamaican accent and was, you know, basically just this really racist Jamaican accent and said, yeah, well, you know, whatever. And and then the information that he was given a couple of phone numbers to call. They didn't lead anywhere. It was an endless automated loop where it just rang and no one ever picked up. And so again, this isn't just a violation of his rights in terms of the Fourth Amendment and the being detained, but also the cruelty that he experienced while being detained. And again, this is also not new. You know, this is not something that just appeared during the Trump presidency, and that the prison system and that policing in general is a violent institution. But the fact that it, again, the blatancy, and then when stuff like this is reported, like, you know that there was no ramifications for the people involved in any of this. And so it just really highlights, maybe that's what it is. It's highlighting the violence and the brutality of the justice system in general, especially as it relates to people of color, even when it relates to people of color who are fucking citizens, whom ICE really should not have any interest in whatsoever. All right, Varsha. So next I want to talk about what's going on in Wisconsin and North Carolina and in Michigan as well. And all of these states have elected Democratic leaders, and the currently held Republican majority is trying to basically do this naked power grab. So can you take us through that a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, first thing to remember is, like, if we begin with Wisconsin, right? Wisconsin finally got rid of national disgrace, according to the AFL-CIO, Scott Walker. And so Scott Walker is no longer the governor, at least, you know, his final month in office is now, right? But he is pushing for one last power grab, as news outlets have called it. So basically, after the midterm election, Walker's moving ahead with a sweeping lame duck agenda, which is basically going to slash early voting, change the election calendar to favor the GOP, shrink the power of the state attorney general, who's going to be a Democrat, and another bill is going to propose to limit the power of Governor-elect Tony Evers to enact administrative rules that implement state laws. So basically, remember when North Carolina finally elected Roy Cooper, a Democrat? North Carolina's state senators and House, which are all Republicans, try to do the same thing, to basically pull a shit ton of power from the governor. And this is what's happening in Wisconsin as well. And so basically, Mark Elias, who's a Democratic attorney who examines, like, voting issues and basically horrific power grabs like this, who also went to Florida to oversee the recounts, basically said that, like, they cannot cut early voting without a fight. And so Democrats and activists in Wisconsin are fighting against this, but the GOP is not alone. So Michigan also is doing this. So Representative Rob Verhulen, he's introducing a bill that allows the state House of Representatives and the Senate to intervene in, quote, any legal proceedings involving the state, a task currently taken care of by the state attorney general and the governor. Both of these positions, guess what, are going to be assumed by Democrats in January. So right. There's a long history of opposition parties trying to do this during lame duck sessions, and it's horrific, and it's not something that should be done. And it's something that actually happened against Walker too in 2010. Democrats unsuccessfully tried to push through public union contracts ahead of Walker's gubernatorial tenure. I mean, what Democrats are trying to do in 2010, we're going to help public unions. And this is just, you know, what Walker's trying to do is just trying to cut early voting and make it so Wisconsin can continuously keep control under Republicans.
Well, let me just stop you there, because in 2010, when they tried to push through union contracts, that feels a little different than changing voting laws. I mean, pushing through union contracts was probably maybe unethical is maybe the wrong word, but, you know, a little underhanded. But but they weren't changing the underlying structure of the power of the state.
Exactly.
Contracts come up for renewal. Like you know, these issues are not necessarily structural in nature.
Yeah. It's bad what's happening. It's basically – so in both Wisconsin and Michigan, both governments have proposed a bunch of bills that touch everything from, as I mentioned, voting to the judicial system. And it basically is a way to strip power from the fact that both these states have won the governor, attorney general, and secretary of state races, right? And what these three races control is the governor controls basically the enforcement of all laws in the state, and they can do a variety of things such as appoint judges, and et cetera, et cetera. The attorney general.
Basically the president of the state.
Yeah. And the attorney general deals with a lot of things, from policing to dealing with cases to dealing with almost everything, right? And the secretary of state deals with one of the most important things, which is voting. And that's right. Voting is two of the most voting is the most important thing that's going to be an issue in Wisconsin and Michigan come 2020, but also just for fucking democracy, right? And so it's really, really authoritarian, and it's something that I think it's really important to distance this story from a Trump type story. This isn't Trumpy Republicans doing this. These are Republicans who have done this, who would have done this regardless of who the fuck is president right now. This is rank and file. This is what Republicans do when they lose, instead of saying, whoop, we lost, and like wipe their hands of it and go, we'll fight another day and we'll try to win in 2020 or try to win in the next election. They go, no, let's try to strip power completely in the most undemocratic way possible. Right. And it's horrific. But this is not as bad as what happened in North Carolina in the 9th district, right? So in the 9th district, something even worse happened. So in the 9th district, there was voting, right, to decide who is going to be the congressperson in this state's 12th and 13th congressional districts. The state board of elections has not certified the results of this 9th district. Finally, there's a delay in certification and irregularities in Bladen County because they saw the state's highest return of absentee ballot requests, and an unusually large number of them are returned. And you're like, okay, fine. A lot of people voted in 2018. That must be normal. But what happened is that a lot more Republicans voted than Democrats. Then a lot more Republicans voted than there are like registered Republicans. Apparently there's only like 20 or 30% registered Republicans in the district. But for some reason, like 80% of returned absentee ballots were Republican.
Right.
And so multiple voters in this district have filed affidavits saying that somebody came to their door to collect their absentee ballots, which is illegal, especially in North Carolina, including one voter who said they were told the person at the door would, quote, finish the ballot because the person only had two races filled in. Yeah. Yeah. So you know how we always say voter fraud isn't a real thing? This is one clear example of fucking voter fraud.
Right,
and guess what? It's right. Not the Democrats, right? And what's really frustrating about this story, about North Carolina and the 9th District, is there is no national Republican who's holding office right now who has condemned this. If this happened in a Democratic county and Democrats are pulling this bullshit, this basically, like, if you've ever watched if you've ever read old history books about big politics in like certain cities like Chicago and New York, there would be outrage if Democrats were the one pulling this. This is basically election meddling. This is fucking illegal shit. And
nobody
fucking cares. And this is another example of what we'd like to talk about, the authoritarian creep, where no one cares. Where very few people are caring about this, and it's not front page news. Same thing with what's happening in Wisconsin and Michigan. It is not front page news in the New York Times or the Washington Post. Like you have to be paying attention.
Well, and the thing is I think a part of it too is we talk so much about voting, and voting is a very concrete action.
Yeah.
In terms of like get your butt to the polls or fill out your absentee ballot, send it in. It's very concrete, but it's also very abstract.
Yeah.
Right. There's this sort of ethereal quality about voting. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's a little like wishy-washy of me, but there's something very disconnected about voting that people have a really hard time caring about. But you're so right, Marcia. I mean, that when you talk about authoritarian creep, one of the main ways in which we lose power as an electorate and the way that authoritarian regimes take over is through the loss of voting and through the loss of the voice of the people. And so these sort of stories are terrifying because they point to the slip in a very concrete way that feels very abstract. So the way we think through it is abstract, but what's actually happening is very concrete. And it's one of those issues where, like you said, you know, when you're talking about voter fraud as like a concept, voter fraud is not a fucking thing, right?
No.
You know, going to the polls and voting
for somebody
twice
else.
Is not a fucking thing. But then something like collecting these ballots is a very concrete thing. And I think there's like this tension or this dichotomy there that we have a hard time reconciling in our brains. And that is part of why the slippage is so easy.
Yeah, I think that another problem with this is to think about like how Wisconsin is structured in the sense that in this last election, Republicans lost the popular vote by a lot, but for some reason, they still control both chambers of the state legislature and 5 of 8 of congressional seats in the National Congress. And the reason they have that is because of the worst gerrymandering, one of the worst cases of gerrymandering in our whole country, right? And so that's one level of the bullshit when how Republicans try to win elections is to gerrymander the shit out of this. It's like, fuck liberal democracy. We're just going to win whichever way we can. But the second level of this is even if you get the state legislature, you still want national power or you still want statewide office. And if you lose that, we'll just take away power from all of that and say it's like for other reasons or something. And that's
well, and you know what's really interesting about that And this reminds me of something Sarah Kendzior said. I don't know if you know this, but I've talked to Sarah Kendzior about authoritarianism. I swear to God, I'm going to like tattoo that on my fucking forehead. But she said something really interesting. It was actually the interview I did with her for Crush the Midterms. Mm-hmm. I believe it was episode 3. And it was about threats to democracy. You know, in the run up to the midterms, you know, that whole show was about getting involved and voting.
Yeah.
And so talking to her about the threats to democracy was absolutely depressing as fuck. Depressing af. I can't not make fun of you for that, Varsha. I will make fun of you for that forever.
I feel like it's a thing. I feel like people say it.
Okay. Just because people say it doesn't mean it's cool.
Okay.
But, you know, that's fine. I'm not cool either. I just like... Don't say af. But she said something interesting about the midterms. And she said one of the most frightening things was that Republicans didn't seem that concerned mm-hmm. about losing. And part of that is gerrymandering. Yeah. And part of that, I think, is a little more sinister than that.
Yep.
And I always talk about Republicans' long game and how it's really their strongest asset
yeah.
in politics. And the way that they have no problem setting everything on fire while Democrats are like, but the card game. And Republicans are just like, you know, like Angela Bassett style, like light that car on fire.
Yeah.
you know, but what's kind of terrifying about this is the sort of two parts of it in tandem. The gerrymandering you were talking about and the way that Republicans have maintained power even while losing the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And then also the fact that they seem unconcerned about stripping power away for the short term.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like they're not so worried about the long term and that they can just, you know, they're confident that they're going to be able to, you know, even if they've lost this round, as it were, that they'll be able to come back, you know, reverse these laws or flip the power back because they know they're going to ultimately do that. And so taking the teeth out of it for a little while. And maybe I'm not explaining myself super clearly here, but what I mean is I think in tandem, the gerrymandering, the taking the power away, which is not a good long game move.
Yeah.
If you think about it, it's sort of like cutting your nose to spite your mm-hmm. face, because eventually if you're ever back in power, that power is going to be gone. But that's where I pause and say, but will it?
Yeah.
Or is this more long game than I'm seeing? And that feels a little conspiracy theory of me, but not that conspiracy theory of me.
Basically, what's happening in Wisconsin is that there's two levels of this bullshit, right? So there's first the fact that the Republicans lost the popular vote completely. They lost it by a lot of points, but they still have control of the state legislatures, and they have control over 5 of 8 congressional seats. And so that's one level of the undemocratic bullshit in how they win elections, is that they rigged the game so they're able to win even when they don't have the mandate in the popular vote.
Well, right. But then what happens there too, though, is then, like I said, this isn't good long game, right? Taking yeah. this power away. But again, it just makes me think that they have no intention of keeping it. Like you said, it's the party that's in power always mm-hmm. wants to expand that power. So when Obama's there, executive orders, we want that there. Republicans complain about it. And then it switches when there's a Republican president. And that's exactly. always been the case. And that's fine. But you're right. I mean, there's this level of hypocrisy mm-hmm. that, I mean, McConnell's uncircumcised penis face just it comes up in my mind, unfortunately, every time I think about this, because of like the utter hypocrisy there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, think about the fact that so no matter what happens, when Republicans don't like the results of their elections, they seek to change the rules of how like everything works,
the
right?
game,
and
yeah.
They seek to change the rules of the game, and then they criticize Democrats for being undemocratic. So in Florida, what is it? Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum call for a recount because they have the right to call for a recount. It's in the fucking books. And when they lose the recount, they graciously concede. But during the process of the recount, you have Marco Rubio tweeting out conspiracy theories about how people in Broward County are stealing fucking votes. It's complete bullshit. And it is really, really dangerous, right? So this slate of laws, even though there are experts on both sides of what's happening in Michigan and Wisconsin who are saying technically they have the constitutional authority to do this, right? It doesn't matter if they technically have the constitutional authority to do this. If it's technically legal, it just means the law is fucking stupid.
Just because something's legal doesn't make it right. And just because something is right doesn't make it legal.
Yeah. And you still have, so in North Carolina, you still have Roy Cooper who is suing in order to get power that every single Republican governor before him and Democratic governor before him had powers for, right? And had the power to do. So it's incredibly dangerous that this is happening. And I think what's the most important thing that people can do and people are doing is activists on the ground are saying, no, fuck this. And they've been protesting this. And so if you're from Wisconsin, call your legislators about this. If you're in Michigan, call your legislators because this is unacceptable, right? And this is why, like, even though we won the House in the midterms, even though we won 40 fucking seats, Republicans are going to stop at nothing to gain power at the state level, at the national level, and at the local level. And so you have to find ways to continuously fight for your vote to count, because that's exactly like when you say you talk to Sarah Kendzior, that's exactly the point that she's making, is that Republicans find a way to, even if you vote, even if you vote them out of fucking office, they find a way to make sure that your vote doesn't count. And they do it in a variety of ways. They do it with voter suppression, they do it with gerrymandering, and now they do it with bullshit laws to take power away from the seats that you won. Right.
Well, and then, yeah, I mean, just the idea of free and fair elections. Mm-hmm. Again, this is where it's so concrete and so abstract, because we have, as Americans, one of the beautiful things about Americans that I believe, and I've talked about this before in my like Pollyanna pants view mm-hmm. of America, but there's this like unbreakable faith that a lot of Americans have. And it's annoying as fuck when that unbreakable faith is directed at something that makes no fucking sense.
Yeah.
But like one thing that most Americans have that is kind of beautiful, but also worrying is the faith in free and fair elections.
Yeah.
And we think that there is something unshakable about that. And we think that, you know, even if you love the idea of gerrymandering and voter suppression and all of this, you at least feel for yourself that you are at a free and fair election. Other people don't deserve that, but you deserve that, especially if you're white. You know, there's this idea that we have free and fair elections and that nothing will take that away ever.
Yeah.
And that really manifests itself in these sort of laws, because it's always white dudes making these laws because they truly believe that that's something that can't be taken from them.
Yeah.
They only want to take it from other people, but they believe that it will stay with them. And that is really dangerous. We have to constant vigilance about this, because taking away free and fair elections will be the death knell of democracy.
Yeah.
And this little democratic experiment, to loosely quote Hamilton again, because I've been listening to it nonstop.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I also love the sly Harry Potter reference, constant vigilance, because fuck yeah.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. I reread that. I've been rereading it too. I didn't know if you would get that. I love that.
Okay. There is no Harry Potter reference I will not get. I think at some point, all of Hellbent, we should have a Harry Potter trivia night. We should go to a bar in LA and run our own trivia night, and it would be amazing.
Oh my God. Yeah. We totally should.
We should also
should do a whole episode about Harry Potter.
Yes. Oh my God, yes. Also, we should fight for democracy when we can. Liberal democracy if you can keep it, right?
Right. As long as we're doing things. So let's move on quickly. I know we were going to talk about trade. We're running a little long here. But Varsha, as someone who understands this much more deeply and much more, not like, you're way smarter than I am. So can you please explain some of what's going on with this trade?
Yeah.
Nonsense?
So there's two things going on. One with NAFTA, one with China. So recently, Trump and Xi Jinping decided to hold off temporarily on increasing tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese-made goods in exchange for...
So a ceasefire. Yeah, please continue.
Yeah,
finish
basically it's like it's a truce, right? A temporary truce on increasing tariffs on the U.S. side in exchange for China saying, we're going to purchase a, quote, not yet agreed upon, but very substantial amount of American-made products. It's not really a big thing to celebrate, but obviously Trump is a liar, and so he's basically celebrating it a lot. And the funny thing is, because you have to find the funny things, he tweeted, of course, but he tweeted this quote, which I fucking love, or this is from one of his tweets: relations with China have taken a, quote, have taken a big leap forward. And so for all my history nerds out there, leap forward should remind you of something. It should remind you of the Great Leap Forward, which was an economic and social campaign by the Communist Party of China from 58 to 62. Basically, it was led by Chairman Mao, and it was aimed to basically rapidly transform the country, China's agrarian economy, to a socialist society with a shit ton of industrialization and collectivization. However, as most leap forwards and five-year plans in history will tell you, it was really, really shitty. And historians agree that it basically caused the great Chinese famine. And so I just find it funny that none of Trump's aides was like, hey, maybe don't use the word leap forward, because one, you're not a communist, and two, that has really negative connotations.
Well, and you know that Trump has no idea that he's making like a reference to anything specific, because there's no way he knows anything about the Great Leap Forward. But yeah, like you said, it's interesting that none of his aides or people that he works with, or even Fox News, you know, lackeys, toadies,
But that's the reason I read that tweet out is because it represents exactly what's going on, because his aides, people who work in trade in the administration, have no idea what the fuck is going on. They're saying different things. So initially, somebody pointed out, like, quote, it doesn't seem like anything was actually agreed to at the dinner. And White House officials are basically, quote, contorting themselves into pretzels to reconcile Trump's tweets, which may be completely fabricated or at least exaggerated, with reality.
Wow. Wait, so this isn't even, so this goes back to when Trump said, I consulted with my generals and we're not going to allow transgender service members in the military. And the generals were like, no, we fucking didn't.
Yeah. That's basically what's happened, is that initially some people are saying, oh yeah, this is correct. We're, you know, we have a great agreement. Everything's fine. And then other people are saying, yeah, I have no idea what the fuck is going on. That's basically what's happening with China and trade. And then the other thing, really quickly, with USMCA, which is USMCA, it's the new NAFTA deal.
USMCA.
Yeah, it's the new NAFTA deal. Basically, it has a bunch of changes, but we have no idea if it's going to be approved by all three governments, let alone if it's going to be approved by the U.S. Congress. Because the way government works in the United States is, if you have a trade deal, it has to be approved by Congress, not just the president. And Democrats have control of the House in 2019. So, yeah, Democrats currently don't like the deal.
And right. And so he's threatening to pull out of NAFTA early to force Congress to pass USMCA. Yeah. Which is my favorite thing to say now. Can you give us like a super fast rundown of what pulling out of NAFTA would do?
What pulling out of NAFTA would do would basically ruin a shit ton of trade, not just for Mexico and Canada, in terms of like our closest trade allies, but it would also ruin a lot of American industries, because you have so much shit that we sell to Canada and to Mexico, right? From automobile to agriculture to basically everything. And so there are a few changes from NAFTA to USMCA. So basically there's a change in country of origin rules, which basically means automobiles must have 75% of their components manufactured in Mexico, US, or Canada to qualify for zero tariffs, which means if less than 75% are made in these three countries, they will have tariffs. There's also labor provisions, basically said that 40 to 45% of these automobile parts have to be made by workers who at least earn $16 an hour by 2023. And that's going to be difficult. And I think it's an interesting proposal, but it's going to be difficult to pass in all three countries. U.S. Right. farmers are going to get more access to the Canadian dairy market. If you've been paying attention to Trump's tweets, he's obsessed with dairy in Canada. There's also intellectual property and digital trade changes. This is a really important one. So Section 232 of NAFTA is a trade loophole that Trump used to impose steel and aluminum tariffs, right? There's no protection against that loophole in this new USMCA deal. This is going to really piss off Canada, especially Canada. And there's also a 16-year sunset clause, meaning that the agreement could sunset after a set period of time, and it would also be reviewed every 6 years. And so this is another thing that could throw a wrench in getting it passed, not just in the U.S., but also in the other two countries. And so it's just a mess. Basically, yeah. What you should get from the China and the NAFTA negotiations is that Donald Trump is making a crap ton of promises, but we do not know, and we are most likely certain that none of these promises are going to come to fruition, because all of this is sort of in the air right now. And it basically, the reason the Great Leap Forward joke is funny is, and also sad, is because that's basically what's happening, is that they're making a shit ton of promises and it's all just going to end up as a big mess because we have a president who doesn't know how to follow through on anything.
Pulling out of NAFTA to force a vote on USMCA would devastate American industry. Yeah. And again, it's just, it's not interesting or funny, but it does kind of give away the game in terms of Trump running on this very pro-industry, bring back the coal jobs mm-hmm. kind of rhetoric, and then turning around and doing everything he can to decimate existing American yeah. industry. I mean, again, it's not funny. And it's not even really ironic. It's more sickening. Yeah. And just the absolute depth of depravity here and the fact that there's no empathy or understanding on Trump's part is really very frustrating.
Yeah, it's just it's going to be a mess. And the thing about trade is, at least on the Democratic side, is that it's a really complicated issue. There are people who are to the far left in the Democratic Party and people who are more blue dog who have totally different views on trade. And it's important to discuss those, especially with Republicans, because they also have totally different views on trade. And those views on trade by Republicans are changing as well because of the way Trump has affected the Republican Party. But that those are not the discussions we're having. And it's because Donald Trump is making all of these promises and not following through. And it's making a mess of what should be an orderly process. And he's sort of just throwing grenades in by saying, oh, we'll just put $200 billion of tariffs here. Now we're going to take those tariffs out. And oh, I'm going to pull out of NAFTA. So it's not a secure situation.
All right, Varsha. So last but not least, some action items. So what is something that our Hellions can do after they listen to the show?
Yeah. So the first thing that people can do is donate to the California Community Foundation's Wildfire Relief Fund. So basically, this foundation has been offering aid to those affected by the wildfires in California. And it's really, really important that we do so because a lot of people have lost not just their houses, but their communities and a lot of their belongings. And the grants have gone to help rebuild homes, provide financial and mental health assistance, and also to get medical treatment. So you should donate to that because what's going on in California after these fires, it's really important. And eventually these fires are going to get worse. So we have to do our best to help people who are affected now.
We didn't even talk about the whole G20 summit and every other leader affirming their commitment to fighting climate change except for Trump.
Yeah.
But that's a story for another fucking day.
Yep. And then the second thing people can do is that you can call, if you live in Wisconsin and Michigan, you should call your legislators and tell them what Republicans are doing is bullshit. And if you live in a district in Wisconsin or Michigan that has a Republican state representative, tell them what they're doing is bullshit. And you will not be supporting them in the next election. And you will do whatever you can to unseat them if they try to pass these undemocratic yeah. bills.
Well, Varsha, I think that is it for us. I feel like that was a really good episode. I'm feeling good about it.
That was good. I think we should pat ourselves on the back for getting through all of this. And
somewhat on schedule. I'm pretty proud of us. So we will be back here later this week. And until then, have a great week, Hellions. Raise some hell and remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.